Well, good morning. This is Per Fagerang, and the show is Political Perspectives. And our guest today is Joshua Holland, who is an editor and senior writer at Alternet, wonderful website. And he is the author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy and Everything Else the Right Doesn't Want You to Know About Taxes, Jobs, and Corporate America. And he will be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, and that is at Southwest 12th and Salmon. So anyway, that is happening tonight, and Joshua, are you there?
I am.
Well,
thanks
good morning. Welcome
good
to KBOO.
Thanks so much.
Well, you know, there's so many things in that book. It's and I wondered where to start, but then I saw that article you wrote more recently about a different legal system for the rich. And so maybe I thought, why don't we start there? Because that kind of leads into your book anyway.
It does, yeah. You know, the that piece, I looked at a few different things. I hooked that to a story that of a recent hit and run in Colorado where the perpetrator of this hit and run was a hedge fund manager who controlled, you know, maybe $1 billion worth of assets. And he hit a bicyclist on the road who suffered very severe injuries and will be, you know, facing basically permanent pain. And the prosecutor in the case decided to accept a misdemeanor plea deal over the objections of the victim. And he went to the media and he said, the reason that I'm accepting this deal is that the SEC requires that if you're convicted of a felony, you have to report that within 30 days. And he was worried about his career, his ability to make money in the future. And this is kind of a pervasive kind of cultural thing that's come through, I think, from many years of economic philosophy into other spheres of our society, including the legal culture. And then I looked at some other factors like the Supreme Court, for example, is considering a case that in all likelihood will end class action suits as we know it. Now, those suits are easy to demagogue because lawyers make a lot of money off of them and individuals don't. But the other side of that is that it's an important tool for keeping companies honest. It's a way for people who have been harmed to only, you know, only buy $50 or $100 and could not individually sue for that to get together and sue as a group. And so you get these companies that do kind of like rip-offs. The case that the Supreme Court is going to look at is a cell phone company that was ripping off customers only $25 a pop. And, you know, this is something that I think has come from a long assault on the middle class, a class war from above. And it's, again, spilled over into other spheres.
Can you take a corporation to small claims court?
Well, you actually
enough people
can't.
Did that, you kind of tie up their lawyers or something, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's very difficult. You know, there are small claims, but there are barriers to small claims actions. And again, if it's $25 or $30, you know, think about making a rational cost-benefit analysis. If you're going to spend 6 hours in court, 7 hours in court for a $25 offense, file a lot of paperwork, is that worth it? I probably would not.
Well, it depends how aggrieved you feel. You know, it's interesting about that hit-run case. You know, you could almost see that as a metaphor for what Wall Street has done to everybody. You know, here we are just kind of innocently pedaling along in our lives, and, you know, we get struck down by this high-powered car. We're left injured, and you know, the perpetrator pulls away and tries to escape. He's found out, but he gets off anyway.
The analogy perfect would be if we paid the driver.
There we go.
If we paid him $1,000, then that would be a perfect analogy. Yes, and that's another point that I raised in the article. You know, the number of people who went to prison during the savings and loan scandal during the 80s numbered over 1,000. And no high-level bankers have faced any charges, even though there was rampant fraud throughout the chain of the home mortgage securitization process. Nobody's gone to jail. And why is that? It's because there's a lot of reasons, but one of them is that the number of cops on the financial beat have been cut very, very dramatically. In that article, I talked about how in the 80s, during the SNL scandal, the FBI's financial crimes unit had 1,100 investigators or 1,000 investigators. That had been cut to 250 now. So, you know, if you don't have cops on the street, it's very difficult. At the same time, we have millions of nonviolent drug offenders who we seem to find the time and resources to prosecute.
Oh, yeah. We cram them into dormitories and hallways and gymnasiums in the prisons and everything. It's interesting that the 80s was now that was when Reagan was president.
That's correct.
And they were putting fraudsters in prison, but not doing that now. That's very interesting.
Not only that, but if you think about the policy, what they did was they took over those ailing institutions, and they wiped out the investors, and they wiped out the executives, and they slowly kind of unwound those messes of assets that the S&L crisis was based on. And that was something that they didn't do during the banking crisis, this banking crisis. They were hesitant to do that. And they set up TARP, and they started injecting them with all sorts of cash assistance and taking their toxic assets off of their books. And it's really a different approach. You see how things have changed, shifted to the right, I would say, over the last 30 years, even since Reagan. I think that Ronald Reagan today would be viewed by today's conservatives as a so-called rhino Republican in name only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Tea Partiers would be furious with him. he passed amnesty for undocumented immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
He raised taxes, I think, seven times in the last, between 1983 and 1988. He's a rhino.
He did a few messy wars, but so are our present leaders. So.
That's right.
Well, you know, in your book, The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy, it's very interesting. In the intro, you sort of set the background for all this. And two things that kind of came out of that was that ever since the 1970s, there's been a kind of a long economic downturn where growth went from more than 5% to 3%. And which means that investors are kind of looking to other places to put their money. And then the other trend is globalization, where U.S. manufacturing went from, as a share of our GDP, went from 30% in 1953 all the way down to 12% in 2005. So those are two really very important trends. And so why don't we talk about that a bit, and then we'll get on to some of the lies, and we will invite callers. Number is 503-231-8187. So why don't we talk about these two trends, and then name your favorite lie.
Sure, yes. I mean, when you saw during the post-war boom, there was a very healthy return on kind of traditional economic sectors, manufacturing, agriculture. That declined worldwide for all the leading industrialized nations. And investors needed to find new methods of squeezing out additional returns. And this was, you know, this ushered in part the era of globalization. And I think that, you know, we've been told for very, very long that when we offshore manufacturing, we're replacing that with more value-added jobs, which are service jobs. And I think that when you look at the actual economic literature, that's not borne out at all. Another thing that we've been told is that we're the technology innovators, and that's why we don't need manufacturing. But, you know, manufacturing has always spurned technology. And if you look at how quickly the Chinese have caught up with us in terms of technological capacity, I think that that's a testament to how closely married manufacturing is to technological innovation. The third part of this is that a lot of people, I think, don't understand the connection between, offshoring and the process of globalization and unionization. A lot of those jobs that went to other countries were the kinds of, solid middle class, often union jobs that, you know, allowed people to live the quote-unquote American dream throughout the post-war era. And a lot of those jobs are gone. And that's why our unionization rate in the private sector has decreased from 30-some-odd percent, almost 40% in mid-century, to 7.2% last year in the private sector.
Well, you know, one big part of the American dream is owning your own home, which That kind of leads into why I think my favorite lie is the one, number four, is the lie that somehow the big banks are the victims in this big mortgage meltdown. So why don't we talk about that? I mean,
yeah, that's a pervasive lie on, among conservatives. It's the story goes like this, and you can hear this from Fox News commentators or Rush Limbaugh. A lot of Republican politicians like to talk about this. There is something called the encourages, and I want to stress that. It encourages banks to lend in all of the areas where they have branches. It does not mandate anything. The story that they tell is that this thing required banks to loan money to people who were poor, minorities, incapable of paying, and in response to government pressure, they lowered their lending standards.
Actually, this was sort of a mild remedy to redlining, which has been with us for a long time.
It is a very mild remedy. And the kind of, there are no sanctions for banks that don't comply. All that it means if you don't comply is that they can use that as a factor when reviewing your application to open up a new branch or merge with another bank. And the thing that everybody in the banking industry knows is that that requirement is so easy to satisfy. It is basically, you know, almost pro forma. And the other factor with the Community Reinvestment Act is that it says right in the law that it has to be consistent with sound lending standards. Now, what was really happening is that the banks figured out a way to launder the risk out of risky mortgages. And that's part of what the securitization process is. And then because they basically broken the relationship between the lender and the borrower, they were able to issue endless debt and just you know, take the fees without worrying about the consequences. So, you know, it's not poor people, it's lobbyists and bankers.
Yeah, you know, last week we talked with Michael W. Hudson. Now, he's not the economist. He's a writer. He was with the Wall Street Journal, and he wrote a book called The Monster, all about this mortgage meltdown. And he described some of these sort of subprime loan shops that they seem to be centered around Orange County, California. And their practices, I mean, the way they deceived people and just kind of ripped them off, it goes into great detail. So you start out with these, you know, these really practically loan sharks, you know, in the mortgage business. And then so why don't we go on from there? I mean, this is the reality, you know, is that these people who money and, you know, who signed the mortgages were really hoodwinked.
I mean, you know, I don't completely discount the idea that people got in over their heads. They clearly did. The point that I think is really important to recognize is that there was a hard sale on. There was a hard sale on, and that was created by the financial industry's hunger, insatiable hunger for new mortgages to wrap into these mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah, that's the key right there.
That's the key. They wanted so much of it. It was such an easy revenue stream that they exerted enormous amount of pressure on the loan originators, and they were getting their fees, and the bond rating agencies were getting paid off to rate them AAA so that municipal pension funds could buy in. It's just an absolute mess. And the idea that, you know, poor people and, you know, people of color were basically getting a handout by government and the banks were victimized by this is just it's an insidious lie. I mean, it's actually kind of it's shocking that anybody would be so bold as to make it. The other part of that is that there are these two, you know, institutions, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, now owned by the U.S. government, but at the time they were these private institutions with a dual mandate to encourage lending and to turn a profit for their shareholders. And this also comes into the conservative narrative that they, you know, they were buying up all these mortgages and lowered lending standards. And the fact, again, is that they were doing it for the profits, just like everybody else.
Well, this is Political Perspectives, and we're talking with Joshua Holland. He's the author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy. He will be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on 12th and Salmon. And if people want to call in with their favorite lie, maybe they've been burned themselves, the number to call is 503-231-8187. So, so here you have this huge flow of money, you know, comes pouring into these little shops in Orange County, you know, and they sort of turn themselves into mortgage bankers or something like that, and the way they ripped off the public, this other book goes into great detail, but these people were scammed. Like one favorite trick was you sign a stack of papers, and the one on top says you have a fixed rate mortgage, you know, which is what the borrower wants. And then further down, there's a paper for an adjustable rate mortgage. Well, you know, the guy signs, goes down the stack of paper, signs them all, and then the dealer takes the one off the top and throws it away. So basically, the borrower is scammed into an adjustable rate mortgage. That's just one little trick.
Call that a crime. I mean, the thing is that, and this I find so frequent, is that if you look at the corporate media's treatment of the entire banking imbroglio, it's always kind of portrayed as we hear about sloppy paperwork. I mean, there wasn't sloppy paperwork. All of these things, if an individual did them, they would go to jail.
There we go. I think we got a caller on the line. Roger's on the line. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Per. I've got a question for your guest.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly when, but quite a while back, I heard one media segment. I don't remember where, but it detailed the idea that there was a FBI report in 2004 that outlined the harm that would be done by these banks like IndyMac of California. And is there any way to find out who suppressed that and really say who did that?
Okay.
I'm very sorry. I'm not familiar with the FBI report from 2004. This is the first I'm hearing about it.
Seems to me I heard something about it, but I don't remember what all the details were.
I'm sorry, I can't answer.
Does the caller, do you have any?
Well, I thought that I would hear about it again, but I've been listening and not a hint from anyone, anywhere, anytime.
So this was an FBI report in like 2004.
Yeah, I'm sure it was 2004, and holy smoke, that would be a smoking gun.
Yeah, seems like you all ought to do a web search for that one.
Well, let me just say on the flip side, I'm not familiar with the FBI report, but if you look at the mainstream corporate media, they were incapable of seeing the enormous housing bubble in advance. It was not hard to see. There were economists, I can name them, you know, Peter Schiller, Dean Baker, Noriel Rubini. There were people who were saying, look, the values of these assets have nothing to do with the laws of supply and demand. This is an asset bubble. And, they were the minority of voices. And most of the mainstream economic reporters kind of accepted the idea that these housing prices were normal and would continue to rise.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so
thanks.
Like this was impossible to see in advance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for that call. I think we'll go on to our next caller is Joanne. Hi, Joanne.
Yeah, hello. Sir, I was wondering what you think about the use of a large amount of money for this. I was listening to the Oprah show the other day, and Oprah said she was backing this Asian woman who is going to make a complete big change of the education system in the United States. She's going to have a website and then a campaign to get 1 million people and also to get $1 billion. I just wonder if you had any opinion about that type of activity. Thank you.
I'm not familiar with the program that you're talking about. I can say that our education system is plagued with a lot of problems. Overall, financing is not one of them. We spend about $14,000 per student, as opposed to the average of wealthy countries, which is about $9,000. The problem is that those dollars are not spent equally. They're not spread equally so that different students have access to different kinds of classrooms. And there's a lot of focus on a lot of those costs go into tertiary education instead of primary education, so kindergartens and K through 12. And, you know, we also have this kind of testing mentality, which is codified with No Child Left Behind, where we're teaching kids to the test. And this is something that I think is, you know, hurting the overall education quality in the United States.
Okay, you know, as a matter of fact, this is interesting. You know, there's this big move now for sort of privatizing education, you know, pumping up charter schools and things like that. And it just happens there's a meeting at Jefferson High School. I believe it's tomorrow, late afternoon or early evening. You have to check that out. It's a group called Rethinking Schools. It's having a meeting, I believe it's at the Jefferson High School cafeteria, on this very topic. So it's a very opportune call we got. I think we have another caller on the line. George is on the line. Hi, George.
Hello. Yeah, a lie that becoming more and more apparent to me is that when Obama, if you get Obama in there, things would get better. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the movie Inside Job.
I have it, and I just edited a review of it. I haven't seen it yet, though.
Yeah, I saw that, and they point out rather skillfully that all the these people that were in power before Obama came in are just right back in there, Bernanke and et cetera, et cetera. They're the very people that were running things when the meltdown happened and all the mortgage fraud was exposed. They're right back in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sorry.
No, go ahead.
You know, there's obviously a lot of criticism of the Obama administration from liberals or progressives, whatever you want to call them. I think that one of the most valid is that there is an enormous Wall Street influence on his economic team.
Well, they are the government, according to this movie. And I don't jump on bandwagons, but they make a good point.
I mean, I think that I wouldn't say that they are the government. Just the revolving door is very fast spinning, and the influence is huge. And, you know, it can't be underestimated. And I think if you look at the economic policies that the administration has pursued, it has prioritized stabilization of the financial system over helping, you know, real American workers cope with this downturn, stay in their homes, you know, find a job. This was a fundamental, I think, misprioritization of their policy.
Yeah, well, you know, one interesting thing this film points out is that where were the regulators when all this was going on? Well, they were making out like bandits, just like everybody else.
Under-regulation is a crime. I mean, it really is a crime. And we talk about deregulation, that is, you know, eliminating regulations, but I think that the lack of enforcement of the regulations that were on the books is something that isn't discussed as much and probably has more import.
Yeah, well, that film is playing a couple of places in Portland. I don't know how long you're going to be around town. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Well, you know, just I think it was last week we got the news that Peter Orszag, who was Obama's budget guy, he left his position and he's going to go to work for Citigroup.
Yep. Yeah, I think that the opticals of that, as they say in Washington, are just horrid. And I don't really understand why Orszag, who is a very intelligent guy, doesn't see that. I mean, he could do very well at an academic chair. He doesn't need to go to Citi and cash out. It's it blurs the line between the two parties even more than it's already blurry.
I think we got another caller on the line. Ed is on the line. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning, Ed. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. My comment has to do with the fallacy that nobody really saw this whole financial meltdown coming. And I wondered, did you see the movie or the PBS episode about, it's called The Warning?
And I don't have a television, so I'm
open. Oh, man, you got to see that, because there's a woman that was in the government. Her name is Brixley Bourne.
Yes.
And she testified in front of Congress, and Bernanke, Greenspan was there, and, several of the other, you know, gurus of finance. And she basically said that there's a meltdown coming. Her job is to protect the American economy, and she was just basically, you know, laughed out of the room.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. Again, I mentioned a few minutes ago, there really were a small number of very smart people who were screaming it from the rooftops and saying, you know, we have to do something. This is a train coming head on. We see the light in the tunnel, and we're going to get hit. And they were ignored in part because, you know, the standard excuse is there was, quote-unquote, irrational exuberance. But again, the stream of fees was just huge. So people were making a lot of money and didn't care. I really want to stress that, didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had basically the Bush administration was in. They had an economic philosophy and regulatory philosophy of hands-off, let the private sector do what it will. And, you know, they rode that bubble up. I think that the bankers, the financial industry, many in the financial industry knew that it was going to pop, you know, and they were making money, and they wouldn't face the consequences. There's a concept in economics called moral hazard, and basically all it means is that you behave differently if you're shielded from the negative consequences from your actions. And these guys were making billions and billions and billions of dollars, and they had every reason to believe that when it crashed, they could go and get a bailout. And that's just what they did.
So when they hit that guy on the bike and drove away, that they knew that they would be nothing bad would happen. You know, another person was warning about this a long time ago is Mike Rupert in his newsletter From the Wilderness, which is not publishing anymore, but is still available on the Internet. And he's got a website called Collapse Network, which is interesting to check out. But I think
a lot of people saw it, just not a lot of people in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah.
And when I say that, I'm not saying that these people weren't, you know, were freaks. And many of them were prestigious academics, for example, and talking about this to the public. So their voices were not prominent in the lead up to the crash.
Well, they should have been in the mainstream, but they weren't, which is a whole other thing to talk about. But
yes,
I think we have another caller on the line. Marilyn's on the line. Morning, Marilyn.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much for making all this a little more plain.
Thank you.
It's nice to move from vaguely threatening to, you know, really getting an idea.
The full impact, yes. This is full impact radio here.
I wanted to ask you, what's the chances of, say, we overcome all the federal, all the money that's going to be spent on the election, and we find a good candidate, you know, maybe a green candidate and so forth, and put them in office next term? And what's the chances of getting through the justice system and correcting any of this stuff?
Well, you know, there are huge barriers to third-party entry. This is really the two main parties have cooked the books to the point where it's very, very, very difficult to make a real challenge from a third-party platform. It has been done. You know, Ross Perot got, I think, 19% of the vote in 1992.
Yeah, they're pretty much public enemy number one.
Yeah, it's very difficult. You know, I used to be involved with the Greens, and now I don't really pursue party politics. But the challenges are multiple, right? You have this basically there's barriers to entry, and then those barriers to entry would need an enormous amount of grassroots organization and capital to overcome, and people and money stay away from third parties because of those barriers.
Right.
So you have this kind of vicious cycle. To overcome them, you would need a lot of support. You're not going to get that support because those barriers exist.
And the guys that are going to get the tax cut renewed, they'll just use their money to buy the next election.
Yeah, I mean, these tax cuts, this tax cut deal is, I don't think it's quite as bad as a lot of progressives are saying, but it's certainly not good, and I think I'm, like everybody else, I'm very disappointed in the quality of the fight that led up to it. If this were something that was the final outcome after a blistering fight where the Democrats really drove home that the Republicans were holding Americans hostage, that would be one thing. But this capitulation from the president, he basically projected that weeks ago. We saw this coming weeks ago.
Well, you know, there is a thing here in several states is kind of a fusion voting, and they just started it in Oregon where a third party can have one of the, say, a Democrat as their candidate. And that way, if, you know, in the real fusion voting, you can vote for a candidate X on this, say, on the Green Party or the Working Families Party ticket, and that way they know that that they sort of depend on a certain number of voters in this third party. Well, they started it here in Oregon, but they got the ballot lines merged, so there's no way of telling. They're supposedly going to correct that soon, but I don't know. Anyway, I think we
in
have
New York, the working in New York State, they have fusion voting.
Mm-hmm.
The Working Families Party has been very successful in local elections. And it's because of the fact that they don't have a spoiler effect.
Mm-hmm.
You can vote for that candidate on the working party's ballot, or you can vote for that same candidate on the green ballot or on the Democratic ballot. It doesn't matter.
Okay, we got another caller on the line. Ryan is on the line. Hi, Ryan.
No, not Ryan. You know me. Buddy.
Brian, yes. Okay.
I have been called worse. okay, I have a couple of points and a question. There's been a thing circulating in my circle of emailers about there's a petition going around to support an Oregon state bank. They're doing it like, you know, North Dakota's done it. And what do you think of that? Also, I'd like to see somebody like, before he drops off the radar since he wasn't re-elected, I'd like to see somebody like, oh God, my mind's going a blank, you know, the progressive from Wisconsin.
Russ Feingold.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's senior
okay.
Moment there. Yeah, I mean, there's already a movement to kind of get him to run. I know he's probably good. And you know, if the Green Party got a tithe of the publicity that these tea buggers, as I call them, get, we might have a viable third party and some real candidates. And this is the press for you. But my question to you guys is, as I'm financially challenged, as it were, is, you know, and I've asked this of quite a few people, is the credit system in this country is, I think, in part responsible for keeping the economy down. I mean, you know, it's merciless. It's financed by the banks. It's beholden to them. And yet it comes over like a government agency. And I would like to see the whole credit system, especially as so many of us have been destroyed by the, you know, practically destroyed by the downturn, and in my case, medical bills. What do you think? Do you think anything can be done about the credit system here? So that,
oh, you mean about the state bank idea?
Well, the state bank mm-hmm. is one, but the whole credit system, you know, it's all run by three bureaus, which sound like they're government, but they're not. They're private. So I'll take the answers off the air, and I hope I wasn't too confusing. Thank you.
No. So you're talking about the credit ratings agencies, yes? I'm not sure what can be done by the about those. Those are private entities, and they have basically established a monopoly on telling us how good we are or bad we are. It is problematic. The state bank is a really interesting concept, and you know the idea is that they do what banks traditionally did, cautious lending, but they also do community investment stuff. I thought it was South Dakota that had the state bank.
North Dakota.
Is correct. Mm-hmm. What's that?
North Dakota.
Is it North?
Yeah, it's been 90 years now.
It's the state that has the lowest unemployment rate. It's the state that has been affected the least by the credit crunch and financial meltdown. They are running budget surpluses. Now, part of that is that they have oil. But if you look at other states with comparable natural resources, it's head and shoulders above everybody else because it's avoided many of those problems that the private banking system has inflicted on the Main Street economy.
I think they can float their bond measures too, can't they?
Yes, they can. And, you know, there's several different states. I understand there's several different states looking at some variation on the state bank.
A little talk
maybe
about
maybe not
it.
Exactly the same as mm-hmm. as the one in the Dakotas. But.
There is some talk here in Oregon about that. But the idea would be that, when you have, say, a bond measure, you find, say, the bond measures for $1 million. Well, the taxpayer winds up spending $2 million because the interest goes to the big banks that lend the money. But if the state bank did that, that interest, which would be lower anyway and would stay within the state and would be put to other beneficial uses.
That's right. That's right. Again, it's a way of insulating a state's economy from the same kind of avaricious banking problems we've had in the other states.
Well, people who support this state bank, they say that in colonial days, the state of Pennsylvania had did that same kind of thing, and that they didn't have to have any taxes there because the money that the state bank made paid for all the services that they needed. Now that's a claim. It'd be very interesting to check that one out. But there's a woman, Ellen Brown, has been writing a lot about this. I think in the Huffington Post and other places. So it seems like I don't know. Do you think that would happen?
Well, I think that there's going to be in order to create a state bank today, mm-hmm. you would have to overcome the lobbying of the banking industry.
Right.
That's a tall order. That's really not a small thing. And you would have fake grassroots campaigns against it, and they mm-hmm. would find an excellent rhetorical strategy to defeat it. This is the situation we face in 2010. There's no question that there would be massive opposition to any proposal to do that today.
Well, banks are in pretty low regard these days, so
that's
you
can
take
true.
Advantage of that. The other
that is true.
In North Dakota, this was a big battle right at the end of World War I, and I think the big proponents of it was the Grange, you know, the farmers groups in North Dakota, because they were being kind of screwed by the big Eastern banks.
And as I understand it, one of the features of the bank is that they lend at cheap rates to farmers.
Right, that's exactly it. Well, we are talking with Joshua Holland, who is the author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy, and he is speaking tonight at the First Unitarian Church. And now it's funny, the address I was given was 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue at Salmon. Well, most of that may be the back door for this Unitarian Church, but the main doors are on 12th, so I'm a little confused about that. But anyway, everybody knows where the First Unitarian Church is. It sort of takes up half the block anyway, between 12th and 13th at Salmon and the next street over. So it's somewhere there in that big Unitarian fortress.
Well, I hope everybody comes down and can find it.
Oh, I think so. They circle the block until you see a lot of people going inside somewhere.
Okay.
What about this, you know, we were talking about the mortgage meltdown, and what do you think is going to happen? You know, right now there's a you know, people have been saying that they can't pay. Even if they had the money, they don't know who to pay because nobody really knows. These mortgages have been kind of sliced up in so many pieces. Nobody knows who owns a piece of property anymore, and no one can produce a note, you know, on the particular property. And now in your article, you talk about these speedy courts in Florida that are supposedly, dealing with this situation. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, the mortgage industry, in order to, state laws require that when you transfer a property or transfer a mortgage for a property, you have to file paperwork. Now, the bankers were trying to do these securitized investment instruments based on mortgages. And in order to do that, they needed to be able to trade very quickly, instantly, millions and millions of mortgages that they would then cut and divide into different securities. And that obviously could not be done if you filed paperwork for each of these transactions. So what they did was they decided, oh, we're smarter than everybody else. We'll create a private company called MERS. And MERS will be the official owner of all of these mortgages and will have an instant electronic trading system. So that's exactly what they did. The result, though, is that these mortgages don't have clear title anymore. Many of them don't. And increasingly, judges are saying, you know, we don't recognize that you have the right to foreclose on this property. And in Florida, they have set up a shop, kind of this judicial sweatshop almost, where they're validating foreclosures at a very rapid clip, hundreds per day. This was originally reported by the Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi, and I quoted his story in my piece. It's a fascinating thing. They've broken the fundamental principle of home ownership. The sanctity of private property is really an important part of what makes capitalism go. And I don't think that that's something that people can take for granted anymore.
Boy, you think, is there any challenge to this? What happens next?
I don't know what happens next. That's going to be up to the courts to decide. You know, the mortgage industry has said that MERS is perfectly legal. A number of states' attorney generals are saying, look, you've basically skipped paying state fees for all of these transactions, and you perhaps owe us tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
How that's resolved is going to be a very important thing to keep an eye on over the next few years. There was talk of floating a bill in Congress that basically would have whitewashed the whole issue away, retroactively granting everybody title. That's not going to pass. That was only at the talking stage. But, you know, some sort of quote-unquote MERS whitewash bill might be in the offing in the future, and this is absolutely something to watch.
Of foreclosed property.
Well, you may not have clean title, and, you know,
yeah.
there's also title insurance companies that are saying, wait a second, you want us to insure this title? Who owns it? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
It's been one-fiftieth of this title has been, you know, 150 of this mortgage has been sold 18 times, and 150th has been sold 72 times to different people, and it's an inextricable mess.
Boy. Okay, we have another caller on the line. Jack is on the line.
Right. Just about everything you're saying here, and people, you know, saying, oh, well, this is just now coming out, da-da-da. It has been out for a long time, really. If you're listening and reading in certain places, and I would point to the historian and economist Webster Griffin Tarpley, who was talking about this stuff for last 10 years really, and in his book Obama the Postmodern Coup, he's talking about Obama's being owned and wholly controlled by Wall Street interests even before the election. So, you know, it's been around. Anybody can go to tarpley.net. That's his website. And I'm just curious why he's never on KABU.
Seems to me I've heard his voice on KABU sometime in the past, but I don't really remember that well.
Yeah, I don't recall. But anyway, you know, like you mentioned Matt, was it Matt?
Tybee.
Tybee? Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything, he was on the air last week, and I've heard him interviewed a few times lately. And everything he's saying, like I said, Webster Tarpley was talking about this a year earlier, 2 years earlier, some of it. And, you know, it's out there, you know, the mortgage crisis was amplified so extraordinarily through the derivatives bubble. And, I mean, that's really, really the crux of it. You know, fictitious capital upon fictitious capital. And they kept reselling and reselling this paper, and now it's virtually worthless.
Mm.
And you know, it's pretty clear to anybody who, the analysts who look at this stuff carefully, they, you know, it was pretty clear a long time ago what was going on, and it's just surprising to me that the so-called progressive community is so late coming to this, you know, and I mean, I'm just surprised by it. And one other thing I want to mention before I get off the phone, and it's rarely talked about, but you're probably aware of this, but a lot of, and small business is supposedly touted as being such an engine of economic growth in the U.S., you know, small businessmen, the entrepreneur, that, you know, that whole catechism. Has anybody done any research to find out exactly how much small business is run on unsecured lines of credit?
I don't know. Joshua?
The kind of credit that was available pretty readily during this bubble at 0% to 3% for, you know, a year, 18 months, whatever, and then it would roll over. And if you could retire it, fine, and you'd get another one like that. But they stopped offering that, and now there are a lot of small business people that are stuck with, you know, $20,000 to $50,000, $60,000 being serviced at around 15%, and that's just crushing. And I would bet there are just, you know, thousands and thousands in every community, small business people who are stuck.
Do we have a question here?
The question is any research that you're aware of?
Okay. Is there any Joshua?
I'm not aware of the actual numbers as split between small businesses and others. I would point out that a lot of our discourse around small business, I talk about this in the book, is a little bit misleading, because in the United States, small businesses are defined, depending on what sector they're in, as businesses with less than, it can be 100 or 500 or 1,500 employees, which, you know, normal people do not think of when they think of small businesses. You think of a small business, you think of the mom-and-pop deli, you think of the restaurant owner, you think about the small, you know, lawn care, whatever it is. A lot of the businesses that we count as small businesses would not be counted as small businesses in the EU, in Canada, in Australia, and Japan. And I think that skews the discourse about small businesses. And there is clearly the case that if you look at the opinion survey data, people have a distrust of large businesses, but have very high esteem, hold small businesses in very high esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, everybody can read the polls, and a lot of policies that help large businesses are spun as small business policies. And one other point on that, you know, this idea that small businesses are the engines of job growth is a little bit misleading as well. That is true on its face, but when you dig into those data, what that's driven by is a very small number of companies that are very successful, that are changing, that are transitioning from small to big businesses and hiring a lot of people along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that, you know, if you look at the average small business or the average company that people would think of as a small business, these are not firms that are, you know, adding tons of jobs all the time.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about taxes, because that's so many misleading things been said about taxes. In your book, you make the case that actually, if you total all the tax rates, that everybody in this country pays around 40%.
Give or take. Mm-hmm. And the conservative lie that I, you know, I quote Rush Limbaugh in the book, but I hear this all the time, is that only the wealthy pay taxes. That working people, 50% of American families, this is the usual statistic that's cited, don't pay any taxes. Well, is there any truth to that whatsoever? That's based on a willful distortion of the fact that federal income taxes are very progressive. So 50% of American families don't pay any federal income taxes. But you know what? Federal income taxes do not finance our government. They are one of many, many taxes. And when you add up income taxes, state income taxes, sales taxes, excise taxes, when you add all of that up, as the economist that I cite did, what you see is that whether you're making $20,000 or $500,000, you are paying a rate of somewhere between 35 and 45%, 40%, give or take 5%.
Does that include property taxes?
That includes all taxes.
Oh, wow. That's very interesting. And then, of course, that leads to the question, what do we get for those taxes?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Not a whole lot.
It's funny because if you ask people what the government spends its money on, a lot of people think that a very large share goes to social welfare services, and that's simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
That's a common fallacy that, you know, the government is handing out, it's about handouts to poor people. And you know, handouts to poor people is one of the smallest line items in our budget, believe me.
So what is the biggest? I would say the military is way up there. Is war spending at the top of the list?
Well, the three big ones, and it just so happens that I have an article today on alternet.org, which you can go read about all of these things. The three big ones are Social Security and Medicare and the military spending. But the thing that's a little misleading about that, and I discussed that in the article today, is that when we talk about military spending, we're generally talking about the spending that's within the Defense Department's budget and additional war spending. But there is national security spending spread throughout the budget, throughout this budget. And when you add all of that up, so the defense budget, as narrowly defined, is around 20% of the government spending. But when you add up the real defense budget, the so-called shadow defense budget, it's more like 40%.
Then what about the cost of past wars?
Well, according to one estimate I cite in the book, the cost of past wars, unpaid costs of past wars, accounts for 91% of our national debt, of our long-term national debt. So when you think about everybody and their cousin in the corporate media and politics saying that we have a deficit crisis, I reject that. I don't think that we do have a deficit crisis per se, an economic crisis of having to do with our fiscal outlook, so much as we have an unsustainable military budget problem or a health care cost problem. You know, if we were to pay the same on health care costs per person as the countries that have longer life expectancies than the United States, just those countries, our budget deficit problem long term would disappear and we would be looking at surpluses.
Yeah, you know, I went to that Big America Speaks thing earlier this year, and I resolved the budget thing by cutting the military more than the options presented, and also by adopting the Netherlands health care system. They have supposedly the best health care in the world. They pay $3,700 per capita, where we spend $7,200 per capita. So if we could somehow adopt the Dutch health care system, we'd cut our health care bill by about 45%.
And again, then you turn your deficit outlook into surpluses.
Wow.
I mean, it's really dramatic how the fiscal picture turns around.
Could we spend that the way we did with our the peace dividend?
Remember that peace dividend? That did not really turn out well, did it?
Seems to have dropped, sunk out of sight without a trace or something.
It's funny how they talked about that forever, and then it just didn't, you know, it didn't materialize. They wanted to give us tax cuts.
Kind of like the second coming or something like that. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's I was going to talk about the healthcare crisis, but I think we're running near the end of our show here. But, you know, I think the thing about Social Security is, is the Social Security system, they bought government bonds, and now the government is the government going to default on these bonds for the first time in its history or not?
No, they can't. Mm-hmm. You know, the Social Security Trust Fund is really, really solid. It's they're treasury bills. And this is a very common claim that I hear all the time from conservatives especially, is that these are, you know, worthless IOUs, quote-unquote worthless IOUs.
They're only worthless if the Congress doesn't spend them.
The bottom line is that they're the same worthless IOUs held by other central banks and by millions of Americans in their 401ks.
Right. Okay, well, we've been talking with Joshua Holland, author of the 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy, and he will be speaking tonight at the First Unitarian Church at 7 p.m. So thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And stay tuned for, I believe, Air Cascadia is coming up next.